Welcome to Behind the Panels, Issue 11, the comic book podcast that wraps its hosts in limited edition foil covers. I'm one of your hosts, Richard Gray.
And I'm your other host, David McVeigh. That's good. I like that one.
How are you, Richard?
Now, this week it's out with the old and in with the new as DC's New 52 gets reshuffled and becomes the new 52. Also, what is the Omega effect? Is it something that comes with the Alpha Flight Tailwind? And in movie news, it's Green Arrow, of course, Fantastic Four, The Avengers, Thor 2, and Deadpool.
Really?
And it's our kick-ass pick of the week, Daredevil Visionaries, David. But first, actually, David, can you guess
yes.
who is playing Johnny Storm in this clip?
Nobody can modify an engine like you, man.
Yeah, that's incredible.
You're only saying that because it's true.
You know, the whole country is looking for the Human Torch.
Yeah?
And he's right here working with us on cars.
Well, I've got to do a little welding, guys, so step back for a few seconds. Flame on.
Hey, Johnny, I didn't know you could ignite parts of your body.
The flame from my finger beats a welding torch any day.
It's really nifty.
Every time I use my flame, I learn new things I can do with it. By concentrating, I can keep it away from that gasoline. But if I wanted to, I could merge my flame with that barrel of oil and keep this place heated for months at almost no cost.
Wow.
Reed and I have done a series of tests.
But as Johnny explains his superhuman abilities, one of his ex-teammates is right outside.
What the hell is that?
It was a radio serial, very short-lived radio serial from 1975 from the Fantastic Four. And it was, as you could hear at the end there, that was Stan Lee taking doing the narration, and the dialogue was taken straight from the comics. Now, could you pick who was playing Johnny Storm?
I couldn't. Who was it?
It was 1975. It's a pre-Saturday Night Live, Bill Murray.
You're kidding.
I
did not recognize that voice at all. Wow. Oh my god.
So I think every week we should see if we can find an obscure reference to comics of comic things past.
The things you dig up, Richard.
This is how I spend my week, David.
That is awesome. I had no idea he did that. Wow. Oh, wow. I'm stunned. I'm actually stunned. And that stunned will take me into...
What a scoop!
How was that?
That's your finest segue to date.
It was a little bit slow off the mark because I didn't have my button pushed.
Well, you were slow off the mark with that, but you were very quick off the mark in guessing... which titles DC would be getting rid of, because DC this week have announced that 6 titles will be coming in, but 6 will be going out in the second wave of DC's New 52. Yeah, now, so I think you called pretty much which ones were going out.
All right, let me hear them. Let me hear
them. It's Man of War.
Yeah.
Mr. Terrific.
Yeah.
OMAC.
Oh, yes.
Hawk and Dove.
Oh, yes.
Blackhawks.
I actually didn't see that one coming, but that's all right.
And Static Shock.
Oh, I could see that coming.
Yeah.
Blackhawks is one that I thought they might try and milk for a little bit longer, just because the Blackhawks had kind of had that whole introduction in Birds of Prey for all these years with the character, what's her name? Lady Blackhawk or whatever her name is?
Yeah, exactly.
But
Birds of Prey for a while as well.
Wasn't a great comic book. It wasn't a great standalone.
No.
Yeah, all right. I'm sorry. They had talked about 8, so they've reduced it to 6.
6. Now, the 6 that they're bringing in, even more interesting. One thing somebody pointed out, Newsarama pointed out, that with those 6 titles going out, that pretty much kills a fair chunk of DC's diversity. Static Shock and Mr. Terrific are both African-American characters, and OMAC's Kevin Coe is an Asian-American character.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting observation from Newsarama. But the 6 titles that are coming back in,
wait a minute. Another Batman title?
Yes.
Just because there isn't enough Batman in the New 52.
Now, in the article that we'll link here from Newsarama, there's one listed second, which I'll and third, but I'm just going to ignore those for the moment because I want to talk about those in a bit more depth at the end. There's The Ravagers, which is being described as a spin-off of Scott Lobdell's Superboy and Teen Titans, so another super title.
Another super title.
And it's written by Howard Mackey, and it's about 4 metahuman teens on the run from nowhere. And
which is kind of what Teen Titans is already about.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's GI combat.
Oh, because Men of War was so successful.
No, I'm kind of interested because there's a main. It's going to have a main story and a rotating backup story. So this is very much an old school kind of comic, sort of like what they're doing with All Star Western.
Okay.
So they're going to have the main story, The War That Time Forgot, and it's going to be written by J.T. Kroll, who's writing things like Green Arrow at the moment.
Right.
And it's going to be illustrated by Ariel Olivetti. And the rotating backup stories, one of the first rotating backup stories is going to be The Unknown Soldier, written by Justin Gray and Jimmy Palmiotti, who are writing All-Star Western at the moment. So
fair enough.
There's that kind of thing as well. Now, China Miéville, who's a famous novelist, is doing a series called Dial H.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm just looking down here. Dial H, an updated version of Dial H. I used to read Dial H for Hero.
That's right.
Oh, my God, they're bringing it back.
There was talk about them bringing back Dial H for Hero a while ago, and you know, this is it.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but this was the book where it was actually in the 80s, I remember this, where people could actually write in. Is this the one where, and they would actually say what sort of what hero they wanted them to be?
I'm pretty sure that was right.
I think,
yeah.
And so every week it was a different hero because people would actually put in their opinions and say what they should be. And so it was kind of this. There was a lot of reader interaction with it. It was actually not a bad book.
Yeah, but the basic premise was that someone can actually dial up different superhero powers,
which has also been recently done on television in another form, which was of course Ben 10. Where he'd dial in different aliens to come into. It's kind of an interesting idea because it keeps things fresh. You've always got different things happening.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds good. I like the idea, and I think it's sort of keeping in line with DC's sort of retro thing. Now, the other two titles are even more retro. Now, this is quite interesting. The other two titles are called Earth 2 and World's Finest. Now, these are really interesting because Earth 2, of course, is a very much a Silver Age concept in DC Comics, where there was two separate Earths, and you actually had simultaneous characters playing out, which would actually explain a lot about what's happening with the DCU at the moment. There do seem to be at least two distinct continuities working at the moment.
Yeah, and I was just looking. I'm just jumping ahead in your article here and having a look because it caught my eye. Power Girl.
Yep. So there you go.
But what I think
So Huntress, who's been in the and Paul Levitz, who wrote the Huntress miniseries, is actually saying that there's hints in that Huntress miniseries of what Earth 2 is going to be about and where we're going with that.
So that Huntress miniseries that's been going for three issues now is actually three, four issues, whatever it is actually Earth 2. That's very interesting.
And World's Finest, and it's been written here in this article as WORLD'S,
yep.
But another website actually said it should be correctly spelled S', meaning multiple worlds finest. And that's what that's about. So it's about world building. And then Newsarama goes on in the biggest surprises of the new 52 second wave, and they talk about world building, saying that Earth 2 and World's Finest, being two of the higher profile new launches, and that it's and they're saying that, you know, did Harris misuse the singular modifier in World's Finest? And it said DC seems to be swinging open the doors to the multiverse in earnest, amongst their core new 52 titles so early in its life as the prime DC Earth. In fact, the concept of World's Finest, notice the punctuation, seems to position the new 52 Earth as more of a DC Earth rather than the DC Earth, an interesting tack to take considering DC's presumed intent to continue to try and reach new and lapsed readers. But also they talk about later this year, Grant Morrison's going to have an epic called Multiversity. Which is a series that Morrison has apparently confirmed connects the core DC universe with the other 51 multiple Earths, and something called Pandora watching over it all.
Okay.
So Is DC very intentionally headed down the same path that led to all those crises in the past?
Yeah, can I just jump in here for a second?
Yeah, sure.
from a DC lover's point of view, I want your opinion on this. I'm a little worried about all this.
Mm.
I'm a little worried about the fact that they're actually reopening the multiverse again. I was kind of actually liking the fact that we had gotten rid, in the New 52, we'd gotten rid of all of these multiple Earths and everything, because it was just getting damn confusing.
Yeah. I agree, and I think look, as one of the reasons that they had a crisis in the first place was to tie up all that loose continuity, and the reason that they've had several reboots and crises since is because there are some things that the catch-all crisis didn't cover time around.
And the idea of the New 52 was to streamline the universe.
Absolutely,
it's a reboot. We start again.
Was from issue one. Of all the titles, nothing about this universe was streamlined.
No, sure.
Look, you know, I think we're headed towards another major event, but DC has one every year, so I'm not surprised.
We can't have a major event. We're only 5 issues into the New 52.
Look, you know, it doesn't matter, David.
How could you have a major event in a universe that's only 5 issues old? All right, I'm getting confused. I'm getting a headache.
Yeah.
I was hoping they were going to tell us that, you know, we're going to get it. You know, in the 6 replacement books, we might get like simple things, like, you know, we get a Power Girl book, we get a this book, you know. But no, we're just making it more confusing.
Look, yeah. I'm as confused as you, David. So I think maybe we should move on to Marvel Universe.
All right, let's try them. They got anything better?
Well, they're doing a something called the Omega Effect, which is going to be a 3-part crossover between the April issues of the Avenging Spider-Man, Daredevil, and Punisher, with a really, really disturbing cover.
I think you've lost me already. Hold on, the Omega Effect. So this is another special event that's following the last 2 special events, which are actually still kind of going.
Yeah, this is kind of like a mini event in the middle of it all. The story centers on, and I'm quoting from the Newsarama article here.
Yeah.
It'll be covering Avenging Spider-Man 7, Daredevil 11, and Punisher 10. And the story centers on the Omega Drive currently in Daredevil's possession, which contains critical information on 5 of the top drama organizations in the Marvel Universe. And he's basically trying to beat the clock. And that's when Frank Castle knocks on the door. And so, look, it's just going to be a little mini event in the middle of things here.
It'll be a little mini event that has 17 issues of tie-ins.
Yes.
That'll lead up and into the mini event, because this is what Marvel does. Can I just point out to those who may have forgotten and who aren't keeping score that Fear itself is actually still going?
Yeah.
We're halfway through this second 12-issue miniseries thing that followed on after Fear itself. It's like, I'm sorry, I'm a little evented out.
I don't think this is going to be a major event. I think this is a straight old school crossover.
Okay, I'm hoping so, because I am actually going to start reading Avenging Spider-Man, because Cameron had told us that it was actually pretty good.
Yeah, so I'd like to go back. Seeing it's only up to presumably only issue 4 or 5 now, because it's April's issue will be Avenger.
I think we need to go find some back issues on this and actually look at Avenging Spider-Man. And I would actually be curious to see what this new Daredevil series is like.
Well, if it's only up to 11 and Punisher as well, for that matter, I would like to start reading a bit more Marvel than I have been reading, because God knows I haven't got enough to do with my time.
No, of course not.
So, yeah, no, look, I think it's interesting. Marvel do have its big event happening in 2012, which will be the X-Men versus the Avengers.
Oh, I forgot about that one. That's right.
And, yeah, so I think that this is just like a little mini.
That's the one that stars Jeremy Renner, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
We talked about this on the Cameron show.
We did, and it looks exactly like their Hawkman looks as a Hawkman. Sorry, their Hawkeye looks exactly like Jeremy Renner, which is probably no fluke there at all.
No,
but yeah, so that's what Marvel's doing, and so I don't know if I'll stop reading comics in the next couple of months, because it's all getting too hard.
We just gotta like, you know, just hold on and go for the ride, I think, at this point.
Yeah, well,
it's all getting a little bit.
Good advice.
It's a bit of a bumpy road at the moment. A bit of a bumpy road ahead. Although I did read something that was very interesting. I was reading the editor's notes at the end of one of the New 52, and I'm actually reading Suicide Squad, which I'm quite enjoying.
Right.
And they've just started a new story arc in Suicide Squad. Remember I said that Harley Quinn was actually one of the new Suicide Squatters?
Mm.
Well, she's actually gotten free, and she's gone against them. And now, apparently, the next story arc for the next few issues is them hunting her.
Yeah.
And this is actually looking really interesting at the moment. So I think it's fascinating to see where Suicide Squad is going. That sort of event I like.
I like that as well.
That's an arc where you can sit there and go,
the best event that they've done the last couple of years is probably Blackest Night.
Yes.
And that was just kind of...
And Flashpoint. I quite like Flashpoint.
Because with the exception of the every issue that sort of... And Flashpoint was great as well, because in both of those cases, they were largely contained within their own books.
Mm-hmm.
With Blackest Night, there was the miniseries, and it was largely contained within the Green Lantern books.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was... Every book in the DCU did have a Blackest Night title, but they certainly weren't essential reading. It was just there to show how that was impacting on the rest of the DCU. So no matter what title you were reading... the DCU was affected by what was happening in Blackest Night, but understanding what was going on, and it wasn't necessary. You didn't have to go off and read Blackest Night, and if you were reading Blackest Night, you didn't have to go off and read all the other titles either.
No, what I really liked about Flashpoint was it was actually completely self-contained.
Mm.
So there was Flashpoint, and there were all those tie-in three-part series that were running around, but they were all self-contained. It didn't actually affect the rest of the universe, except for Booster Gold.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and it was only like two crossovers or something into his book where he was saying there's something wrong with the timeline, basically.
They're probably holding off because the rest of the universe was going to be affected very shortly.
Pretty much. But I thought that was actually a very clever idea, so that Flashpoint could just be this little self-contained side story that wasn't – you didn't have to buy into it if you didn't want to.
No, and as we said, it was a love letter to the end of the old DCU.
Agreed.
Or is it? Because we don't know what's happening now.
And the Woman in Red is supposed to be coming back into this at some point.
Yeah, well, that's right. So I think perhaps what we'll find in with the multiversity is perhaps this Woman in Red seems to be someone who can traverse multiple realities. So
I'm very curious to see what they do with all of that. So we will see. All right.
Now, speaking of other realities, I think it's time for a little bit of...
Still creepy that you did that.
Yeah.
All right.
The first story in movie news.
I'm kind of digging this idea.
Now, I'm just going to say, David, if I ever mention that I like Green Arrow.
No.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I'm quite fond of Green Arrow. No, look, it's no secret I'm a huge Green Arrow fan. I quite literally have every issue that he's been in, like going back to the late 60s.
Yeah.
And I'm such a huge fan that I've followed him in all of his televised forms. It actually got me watching Smallville when he joined in the sixth season.
Mm-hmm.
And now the CW's apparently announced that they are ordering a Green Arrow TV series pilot, or they're getting ready to order a pilot. They haven't actually ordered it yet, but EW, Entertainment Weekly, has reported that they're just about to do this. Now, the interesting thing is, it's not going to be a straight spin-off from Smallville, because it won't be Justin Hartley playing Green Arrow, apparently.
That could probably be a good thing, though.
I think so. So they're making a complete break. The creative team behind this, the executive producers and writers are Greg Berlanti, who did Brothers and Sisters.
Yep.
Mark Guggenheim, who did Flash Forward.
Mm-hmm.
And they also both worked on, this is not a positive vibe at all, Green Lantern last year. But also Andrew Kreisberg, who's done Fringe, amongst other things. And he's also written issues of Green Arrow as well.
Can
so
I
he's
just
quite
ask
familiar
a question?
With
these names and their credits are really ringing a bell with me.
Yeah.
Aren't these the people who are behind the Jessica Jones series?
Yes, they are. That's right. I remember when we were like, right.
We
the guys
talked
the
about this.
Sisters.
The
Absolutely,
Brothers and Sisters
yes.
producer. This is interesting. So they're actually, I wonder what's happened with that one then.
I wonder. Well, at this stage, and we know that CW's not had a lot of success with pilots they've ordered in the past. In the very recent memory, we've had Wonder Woman.
No, that was NBC.
Sorry, NBC. Sorry. I meant to say DC-related stuff,
DC,
not CW.
Yeah,
I'm getting my acronyms mixed up. Yes, DC-based pilots in the past, most recently with Wonder Woman, didn't go anywhere after its pilot. And of course, before that, a very good, a strong Green Arrow connection is the Aquaman pilot,
which I actually saw.
Justin Hartley playing Aquaman. That didn't get picked up, but of course he went on to play Green Arrow in Smallville.
Did you see the Aquaman pilot?
I have, actually, yeah.
I actually didn't mind it.
No, I think, you know, it's one of those things, and I'm sure there was nothing wrong with it, but it just didn't grab the executives at the time.
No.
And perhaps it may not have been. Like, I don't know if they knew how to market Aquaman at the time. And I think if they were going to go back to the world, they need to look at DC now to look at how to market Aquaman. It's a very self-referential, tongue-in-cheek kind of thing.
I would watch a series if they did Aquaman like the
movie. As it is,
like,
yeah, absolutely.
That would be an awesome show.
So look, there's that. If this holds to be true, I only have one comment on that, and that's pretty much... That was my initial reaction.
That was your initial reaction. And then you thought that it could end up like the Green Arrow of the New 52.
Yeah, well, there's that.
And then you went...
Yeah. Well, at that point,
my spider senses are starting to tingle.
Oh, there you go.
But so look, that's the possibility that can go in there. But there is some other film news. I had to spend a bit of time on that because I love Green Arrow so much.
We all have our favorites.
We exactly right. But David, are you a Fantastic Four fan?
Book or movie?
A book.
Book, yeah, I don't mind the Fantastic Four. And actually, it's funny, Fantastic Four in doses. I get bored of them after a while.
Yeah, look, I'm pretty much the same way, and I think this is the problem when they try to translate it into a film. It's hard to get what's essentially a book about a super family down pat, although Brad Bird had no problem with The Incredibles.
Although I will say that I am actually, and this is going to be controversial, but I am actually a little bit of a defender of the first Fantastic Four movie.
No, I agree with you.
I actually didn't mind the first Fantastic Four movie, and I actually said when I came out that had there not been the X-Men or Spider-Man or all these like bar-setting films, we would have actually thought Fantastic Four was pretty good.
I still think it is pretty good. Yeah. I mean, Rise of the Silver Surfer is a different story. But
Rise of the Silver Surfer is junk.
But no, Fantastic Four has a lot of great moments in it, and when he's not... In the costume, I think McMahon makes a fine Dr. Doom.
Absolutely, and I think the bridge sequence is actually really well done.
Yeah, and I think absolutely everything of it. So anyway, the interesting thing about this is that, like many of Fox's properties, Marvel properties, I should say, they're rebooting it. And this is not a new announcement. They originally announced that they were rebooting this back in 2009.
Yeah, that's right.
Because for many of the same reasons that we have a 1994 unreleased Roger Corman version of Fantastic Four, Fox have to keep doing something with the property because they have the rights in perpetuity as long as they keep doing something with it.
As does Sony with Spider-Man. So,
absolutely. Yeah. So that's why Spider-Man's getting rebooted. That's why we had X-Men First Class and another Wolverine film on the way. And that's why Daredevil's in talks as well for being rebooted.
That's right. They talked about Daredevil actually a couple of years ago as well. They keep bringing it up.
And so now there's a movie called Chronicle coming out this week, which is sort of one of those found footage.
Looks good. I want to see it.
It does look quite good, actually. And it's called Chronicle, and it's about basically it's a superhero film, but it's a found footage superhero film. And the director, who's Josh Trank, as according to Variety, has been tapped by Fox to do the reboot of Fantastic Four. I'm sure this is pending the financial success of Chronicle. But it'd be interesting that they're going down that path, which is very similar to what Marvel Studios themselves are doing in tapping people who have had one or two features and seeing what direction they want to go. Now, this is great news for people who are still waiting for the definitive Fantastic Four film because they're having another crack at it. Unfortunately, it's bad news for those of us who wanted the rights to lapse back to Marvel Studios. So they're getting
which is what I would really like, because I would really like to see the Fantastic Four being integrated into that current universe.
Oh, absolutely, because I think if you're going to have Tony Stark in that universe, you want to see him interacting with Reed Richards.
Absolutely. And yeah, we're never going to get that, unfortunately. And I'd actually really like to see Daredevil revert back to Marvel, because I think Daredevil is still waiting to be done.
Well, that's the thing.
And well, maybe Fox isn't very good at this.
We never know. Fox might take a lesson from Marvel Studios / Paramount / Disney and see what they've been doing and maybe have an X-Men Fantastic Four, Daredevil, Elektra, Deadpool mashup.
Isn't gonna happen.
You never know, but they own the rights to all of them. And meanwhile, Sony can do I don't know, Spider-Man meets Ghost Rider.
Ghost Rider. Nicolas Cage, yeah, all right. Yeah. Well done, sir.
Which moves us on to a team up that we know is actually happening, which is the Avengers.
Yes. Now, oh, I read this Joss story. Whedon. Yeah. I read this story. This is cool.
Yes. Now, he's Joss Whedon has basically said when a new photo of – there seems to be every photo they released from this film is Captain America and Thor standing on that same strip of street surrounded by rubble.
Facing off each other.
Yeah, I'm convinced 90% of this film is just the two of them standing on that street.
Well, they were cheaper than Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, the rest of it's quips from Robert Downey Jr., absolutely. But what's really encouraging about this, because the trailer made us believe exactly that Robert Downey Jr., it's his show, and he's just going to be doing one-liners throughout the whole thing. But what Joss Whedon's come and said is that he's actually going to make Captain America's perspective, or Steve Rogers' perspective, the focal point with the Avengers, which I think is a really smart move.
Really good idea.
Yeah, and I'm just going to quote Joss, our good friend Joss, briefly here.
Oh, don't we want to junk it with Joss? Come on. We need
Fingers crossed, Dave.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
He says so much of the Avengers story takes place from Steve Rogers' perspective, since he's the guy who just woke up and sees this weird-ass world. Everyone else has been living in it. He's the guy that feels a sense of loss. The Avengers is very much about people who are alone, because I'm writing it. And, of course... The article references, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Firefly, of course, but let's not forget he also wrote the script for the original Toy Story.
Yes, absolutely.
He says Captain America is kind of the ultimate loner in that way. Is it an anachronism to him? And Chris and I have always tried to, without making it too goofy or obvious, make him the same grounded 40s Steve Rogers that he was in the other movie. And I think that's great.
I think it's great. You're actually starting to break up just a little bit on me, Richard. So I'll talk for just a second, hopefully, and just hit your pause and resume on your Skype, and we'll get going again. How's that? I think this is a very...
Sorry, should I just talk to Steve if I'm breaking up?
That's better. That's better. Thank you.
Okay, so do you want me to go back and do that?
No, you're fine. No, you're fine. I'm not even going to edit this out. We're just going to keep it going. That's fine.
Oh, come on. Edit this bit out.
No, that's what happens with Skype. No, you're doing fine. I think this is actually a great idea because the Avengers has the problem that it could sit in a position where it doesn't have a focal point, which is what happens with a lot of ensemble pieces. And I think the fact that you're giving it to the person who has just woken up and isn't outside into the world, I think Joss Whedon is completely correct that he is the best person to be able to see this new weird world.
Absolutely. And look, I'm so excited about this film anyway, but knowing that, it's actually funny. Someone said to me earlier in the week that they'll only really buy into this film if it's Cap's film. Mm. And I think, well, there you go.
There you go. Yeah, All right. Now,
the final.
You got something to say about my girlfriend here.
Okay, well, there's a couple of bits of Thor 2 news. The first one is that, I don't know whether it's Robert Rodat or Robert Rodet, but it's the guy that wrote Saving Private Ryan, right, has been brought in to rewrite Thor 2. Now, as we know, new director, so probably a slight change in focus. So mm-hmm. Patty Jenkins was going to direct the film. She left due to creative differences, has been replaced with Alan Taylor, who's most famous recently for Game of Thrones. It's a no-brainer. So, like, some people might be worried that they're still doing script changes this late in the game. I don't think that's an unusual thing.
I don't think it's unusual at all, especially considering the film doesn't start shooting for another, 5 months?
Yeah, it shoots in London's summer, so it'll be shooting, I guess, June, July, August. This year, and that confirmation comes courtesy of our good friend Tom Hiddleston. The other person who's our good friend is Jamie Alexander. Now, we should point out to new listeners that Tom Hiddleston and Jamie Alexander hold a very special place in our hearts, because not only were they the first major junket that David and I had been on, it's where David and I met.
Absolutely. So we both got to fall in love with Jamie Alexander together.
Absolutely.
And Tom Hiddleston, of course.
But as you said before the show, we didn't end up with Tom Hiddleston or Jamie Alexander. We got stuck with each other.
I know. It's kind of sad, isn't it?
Yeah. So anyway, our good friend Jamie Alexander has confirmed that Sif will appear in Thor 2.
That's kind of a no-brainer, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a no-brainer, but they could have not. Like, you don't know what's going to happen in the Avengers.
That's true.
I think it's good because Sif was such a major character in the Thor comics, and she was such a minor character in the first Thor film that they made the love interest or the female interest the human character.
And in the interview that I gave, the interview that I had with her, because we had separate interviews, in the interview I had with her, she did kind of hint that they had talked about the story arc.
And she's such a uber comic geek anyway. Yeah. So she kind of knew all about Lady Sif and the Warriors 3 and the epic love affair that Thor and Sif had had in the comics. And she was aware of all this.
And she even talked about in the interview, which you can find on my site at geekactually.com, but she also sorry, like that plug? She also talked about the fact that of the arc of stories where Loki took over her body.
Exactly right.
And they had a bit of a laugh about all that.
So I've watched her interview. It's quite good. Yeah. No, so it's
she's aware of all of this. So I would say it's a no-brainer that she's coming back.
It's a no-brainer, but it's nice to have it confirmed. And certainly Thor 2 being the first film in the new in the second Marvel Cinematic Universe run, it's going to set the tone for what comes since, and they know what they're doing at that point. Yeah. They're just going to take the ball and run with it.
I'm just hoping they're a little bit more successful with Thor 2 than they were with Iron Man 2, which I liked. Yeah. Iron Man 2, I actually enjoyed it quite a lot, but it's nowhere near the film the first one was.
Iron Man 2 was a little hamstrung because they did it because it was Iron Man was just so unbelievably popular.
Mm.
And I think they realized they needed to get another one of those out independent of the rest of the cinematic universe.
Yeah.
But they also had to squeeze in
more Avengers stuff.
Mm. So they squeezed in Black Widow, and Nick Fury had a slightly expanded role, and you know, there were issues with the portrayal of Whiplash in that film as well, but look, you know, it's not a train wreck, but it certainly was hamstrung by where it sat.
I think there are people who are far too hard on Iron Man 2. I think it is still a fun film, and it's very.
It's just not Iron Man 1.
It's just not Iron Man 1. Exactly. I mean, that's the thing. It's our expectations were set a lot higher because we were looking for Iron Man 1, et cetera, and I think it's got some amazing sequences in it.
Now, speaking of expectations being set low. it's a good thing that we finished the film actually show half an hour ago, because Josh would react harshly, our co-host on Film Actually, to any mention of Wolverine.
Ah, yes.
The film Wolverine, that is.
Yeah.
Now, the character in that, of course, the other character that they destroyed in that was Deadpool.
Mm. Which he hated the film version of Deadpool.
Yes. Now, we all did, because it was just a completely ridiculous version. But according to Rob Liefeld, who also has his detractors, there may or may not have been shot 8 minutes worth of a R-rated Deadpool film. Now, this was coming from an interview that he gave recently at the amazing Arizona Comic-Con panel. And he said they've got a great director for the movie. They've got a great script. I may or may not have seen some of test footage that would blow your mind if you saw it and go, holy crap, that's Deadpool in costume, katana swords, guns, shooting people's faces off and making me laugh. I may or may not have seen something that looks just like that. And you've got what would amount to the first R-rated X-Men movie, because the script is R-rated.
Huh.
Now, that's interesting, Rob, because I think that would be – if that's true, then I would like to see that film, because I think an R-rated comic book movie is what the Doctor ordered, particularly one set
in. This actually follows suit, because Lauren Shuler Donner, who is producing the X-Men films and Deadpool, has actually said that they have a script that is definitely R-rated, and they're definitely going for an R rating. She said they had no plans to soften Deadpool in any way. So this kind of follows that news as well.
So I don't know if Ryan Reynolds is still going to play the character.
Not mentioning that, are they?
No, because now that he's Green Lantern.
Yeah, but that's not going anywhere at the moment. So.
Yeah, well, that's coming back darker than ever, isn't it? Well,
that's what they tell us. I'll be surprised. You know what? I'll be surprised if a second one comes.
Yeah, that's why.
Yeah, I think they can say what they want. I don't think a second Green Lantern is coming anytime soon. And they don't have to keep making them or they lose the rights. Warner Brothers owns DC. They can just stop if they want to.
Exactly right. And I think DC would be wise with those sorts of properties to concentrate on television and the direct-to-DVD and Blu-ray market.
Which seems to be their strength.
Because the Green Lantern stuff that they've done there has been great so far.
Except for this most recent.
This new TV series, yeah, that's a different story.
This most recent one is not good.
No, but there are things like Emerald Knights and First Flight have been fine.
Yeah, they were fantastic. But once again, it's the Tim stuff.
Yeah, exactly
it's
right.
It's the Bruce Tim stuff. You know, it's like you move away from him and they start to fall apart. Stay with him.
He knows what he's doing.
He knows what he's doing.
Give him a film. Give him a major film.
How about a full length major animated film? Remember, he did Mask of the Phantasm. What was it? Mask of the Phantasm.
The Batman one, yeah. Of course.
Let's do some more of those.
That would be awesome.
That would be awesome. Absolutely. Give him some more money. Let him do what he does on a much bigger scale.
I you've sold me, David. Now let's see if we can sell Warner on this.
Yeah, well, I don't think they're listening somehow. All right, Richard, we're running a little bit long. Let's get into our...
Well, see how you like this.
What is it, Batman?
Whatever it is, it's awfully funny.
It's the pick of the week.
It certainly is. All right. Now, this week we did as a spontaneous... pick last week. Daredevil. What's this thing called again?
It's called Daredevil Visionaries Frank Miller Volume 2 in its trade paperback form.
Not Volume 1, mind you, Volume 2.
But it originally ran as issues number 168 to 182 of the original Daredevil series.
Now, and that all sounded great at the time, but then when I actually started to read this trade paperback, I started to realize...
Book.
That it's 300 and something pages long.
It's about the same length as The Watchmen.
Yeah, there you go. So thank you for that. You've taken up my entire week with...
Sorry, David. I didn't realize how big... I've forgotten how big it was.
It's okay. It was actually very interesting going back and having a look at it again.
Which raises a point, David. I think we should raise it now.
Yeah, okay, go.
Which is the idea of going back and looking at this. In this series that we're doing... The beautiful thing is that we're going back and looking at new issues, like very new things, like we did with Batman Noel. We've looked at some seminal books, like Sandman,
yep.
And also going back and looking at these really classic issues and really getting to see the way that comics have been written over the last 30, 40 years and how that's changed. Now, going back and reading this, which is held up as the classic Daredevil run by Frank Miller.
Yep.
This is the Elektra Bullseye saga, of course. It's really interesting just how antiquated it seems now.
I agree with you. And it's one of the things we're going to probably come back to over and over again as we talk about this. Now, this is so long that we can't go through it issue by issue, unfortunately.
No.
It's too long. We're going to be talking about this one in broad strokes. We'll talk about the basic storyline and stuff like that and the stuff that actually happens in it. But we just can't go issue by issue. It'll take us all night. But I agree with you. I think it's very interesting to go back because we hold people like Frank Miller up as these classic writers of comic bookdom. And of course, Frank Miller is considered that because of stuff like the Dark Knight Returns and Sin City. But it's really interesting when you go back and you look at his early work, and it's full of exposition. And I think you summed it up beautifully, Richard, when you actually said that it kind of feels like the stuff that Stan Lee was writing.
Absolutely, and you get this massive amount of descriptive text and these thought bubbles of him walking around. And you found some great examples of this, David.
Yeah.
but just even little things like my hand shaking. No, not my hand. It's the tracks. Yes, the tracks are vibrating. Can
oh,
only mean
yes,
there's
I
another train.
That.
Another train coming this way. Still can't hear. Radar gone. Can't tell how close train is. Bullseye, he's still out, still on the tracks. And this goes on.
It goes on and on. And the one I found, of course, was he talks about his billy clubs a lot throughout this entire. He actually shows his billy clubs off to people. He goes, "This is my new billy club."
It's almost fetishistic.
It is, and he throughout. Many times, I can't even tell you how many times it was, but I was actually laughing by the end of it every time it would happen. He would talk about the fact that he would have this 30-foot nylon cord that would actually shoot out of his billy club. And I have an example from this one issue where he actually says, the guy's about to jump out a window, and the bartender says, "Oh, geez, he's heading for the window. DD, please, that's three this week. You know how much them things cost." And he says, "Don't worry, Josie. Us daredevils come well-equipped. Note the all-purpose billy club complete with a 30-foot nylon cord. It's good for snagging ledges or flagpoles or crooks." It's like, and he does this. He actually mentions the 30-foot of nylon cord in his billy club. I can't count how many times. And he's like, "I get the idea. There's 30-foot of nylon cord in your billy club."
Now, I think it's really important to contextualize this book in Frank Miller's career. Now, Frank Miller, who would, of course, go on to do Dark Knight Returns, yes, Sin City, and 300 and these other seminal books. His Daredevil run, which began only 10 issues before this one started,
right,
was his debut on that title and one of his first major things that he'd done. Mm. He'd done some spectacular Spider-Man work before that, where he fell in love with the character of Kingpin,
mm-hmm,
who was originally a Spider-Man villain and seen as quite a joke. And here he brings in, he decides to, I think the reason that this thing is so revered, and obviously some of the actual writing itself is patchy or very, I'm not going to say amateur, but it's very traditional.
That's a great word, traditional, yes.
Because it is very much, as I said, like that Stan Lee stuff. The reason this is so revered is the layouts, the plotting, and the stylistic choices that Miller makes. Now, one of the things you'll notice, there's two things that I want to point out here. One of the things that is mentioned in a lot of places is that kind of German expressionist kind of dramatic edges, everything jutting out, that sort of angular thing, which would become a theme for Miller over the years.
Yep.
And that very noirish kind of look to it. But also just the layouts, the different way that the panels are laid out, is very much taking a cue from people like Will Eisner, legendary comics creator, of course, who did just played with the form so much. And Miller's stated on a number of occasions how influenced he is by it. But other things as well, just this is a massive turning point in the history of the Daredevil character, because... a couple of things happen. One, it introduces the character of Elektra.
Yes.
Who Frank Miller believed would be the last time that we ever saw Elektra by the end of this. But no.
No.
She came back. Now, this isn't the first time that Bullseye had been introduced. He was actually introduced a good 30-odd issues earlier. But he brought him back and he made him his own. And I think this is the thing that you can say about this run, is about making the characters his own. And one of the best things that came out of the Daredevil movie was on the DVD, there was this 50-minute documentary on the history of the Daredevil comics.
I remember that, yeah.
And it was terrific. And one of the things I'll always remember, and when I got to it again reading it this time, it stood out as well, was at the end of issue 170. I think it's at the end of issue 170. You see throughout the thing that Kingpin's already been introduced, and he's the big, fat, ridiculous character that he had been in Spider-Man, even though there's an attempt to make him a bit more of a badass by showing him, you know, fighting off, you know, 10 of his own employees and showing that. But he was very much the clown in the Spider-Man story. He was kind of like one of those villains of the week that kind of kept cropping up in all the Spider-Man. He was a ridiculous character.
Yeah.
But then at the end of this issue, in three panels, you see the round-faced Kingpin there. In the next panel, he leans down and he lights a cigarette, his face sort of slightly shrouded in darkness. And the next thing, his face is underlit by the cigarette light, by the lighter, the dark face, the shadows falling across his face with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth, saying, "And my enemies will die, each and every one of them." Suddenly, like that, he's a Frank Miller character.
Yeah. He converted him.
In three panels. Mm. In three panels, he managed to convert him into a Frank Miller character. And I think that is what is so impressive about this run, that all throughout that, he has these terrific layouts where it screams that this is a Frank Miller book. Now, obviously, the story in a nutshell is that this is the first, well, the second meeting, in a way, of Daredevil and Elektra, who met previously, as we're told in flashback, as college students.
Yep.
When they were just Matt Murdock and Elektra Nuttius. They both went, and she was the daughter of an ambassador and a rich, led a rich lifestyle, and, you know, he was a boy who'd been blinded and hadn't quite, you know, and developed these powers but didn't quite know what to do with them. Years later, she's one of the world's top assassins and he's Daredevil.
Yeah, and I love the fact that there's that turmoil that they're both facing, because she's switched off her emotions, or so she thinks, and Matt Murdock is now hunting her because she now represents everything that he's against.
Exactly.
And yet there's still this underlying love between these two characters.
And this is what's really interesting about this, and one of the reasons that I think Miller wrote this is, and I'm sure I read this or saw this in an interview, was when he said he never understood why Superman and Wonder Woman never got together.
I agree.
And because it's kind of like, if you're this powerful guy, you're going to need a partner who's equally as powerful, who can go toe-to-toe with you on every level.
Because let's face it, in the sack, Superman would kill Lois Lane.
Exactly. I watched that great line from from Mallrats. He's got to blow a load like a shotgun.
That's all right.
Unless you used a kryptonite condom, but that, of course, would kill him. On that note, Miller created Elektra as an equal for Matt Murdock. Now, one of the things that Miller infused Daredevil with was that Catholic guilt, was that overwhelming sense of failure if he wasn't living up to these principles, you know. And so that starts to pervade this, but you'll see it more in things like Born Again that he does a bit later. Mm. But this is a very simple story. It is that star-crossed lovers story with a few assassins thrown in for good measure. It is the story that formed the basis of the Daredevil movie, although there is a lot more complexity in this than there ever was in that movie.
Yes.
It is, as an overarching story, quite satisfying. But I think where it falls down almost 30 years later is in those details that we spoke about.
I also just want to go back to the art style a little bit as well. You were talking about the influences on Frank, because it should also be noticed that Frank Miller is actually kind of one of the few out there who actually does his own artwork.
But he did it on this
one. Sorry?
I don't think he did it on this one.
Yeah, he did. No, he did. It's actually on the covers. It actually says written and penciled by Frank Miller.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Oh, no, you're right. Sorry, my bad. I'm thinking Klaus Jensen did the ink. My bad. Go on.
And I was just saying that he's also obviously influenced by Jack Kirby, because he has that sense of perspective and kind of wild framing that Kirby was famous for, which a lot of people have taken their cue from, especially in like the aerial shots where he's going through the city and stuff like that. And you look at it and go, yeah, there's Kirby influences hidden here, definitely, you know, which is not something that you actually get out of his later work.
No, and I think this is probably artistically about the most balanced that that he gets. And there's a lot of penetration in this. There's a lot of
pardon.
There's a lot of penetration. There's a lot of, I'm just flicking through, there's a lot of swords going straight through.
Oh, that kind of penetration.
Well, there's poking actually out the other side. No, not that sort of penetration, David. No. You're still stuck on Superman.
I'm sorry. You just you woke me up there for a second. Let me go.
But also, there's this glorification of the form in this as well. There's this real, that kind of hyper-realistic art style that sort of came out of the 70s. People like Denny O'Neill.
And John Romita.
Sorry?
And John Romita Sr.
Yeah, exactly right. who did those kind of really hyper, who we'll return to next week as well. When we sorry, not Denny O'Neill. I'm thinking, sorry, Neil Adams is the artist, not Dennis O'Neill.
Right.
But very similar writing. They did you know, that really hyper realistic, like it was all muscles, it was kind of like the peak of the human form.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah. It's very, very much a very very heavily what you're describing there is the entire first half of the 80s in comic books.
Yeah, pretty much. And yeah, it's that thing, but that really came out of that late 70s sort of thing, and you really started seeing it in the book that we'll I may as well mention it now, the book that we're going to look at next week, which is Green Lantern, Green Arrow, Hard Traveling Heroes. And you really see that style very clearly in that. And that was about 5 years earlier than this. Mm. But and you see that all throughout this, but you can see that this is where Miller is being influenced from. But if you buy the trade paperback version of this, the cover art that Miller's done for that is the very angular stuff that he would later use in it looks very much more like his the stuff that he would do in Sin City and 300.
That's interesting.
So it's interesting that was just a separate cover that was done for this. So it's you can see how he's progressed artistically, and some would say regressed artistically, over the years. Much like Romita Jr., who went from kind of doing stuff more like his father
to things like Kick-Ass.
To doing Kick-Ass, yeah, where it's very straight angular lines as well, which is the same direction that Miller's gone with his art. Mm. So it's kind of like, and they both kind of were coming up around the same time, I guess. So it's sort of interesting to look back at it from stylistically as well. Look, you know, it's still a great story.
Look, I think I like the fact that it takes its time getting where it has to go. I like the fact that it's not rushed. I love the humor in it, actually. There's some really fabulous pieces of humor, and most of them are visual. We were talking about this before the show, like there's that shot where he's talking to the person about Bullseye's brain, and he's just leaning against the wall with his arms drinking a cup of coffee.
Coffee, there, yeah. You know,
Daredevil drinking coffee, and then later, in one of the later issues, he's talking to Joni on the street, and he's drinking a juice box.
Mm.
And you go, Daredevil shouldn't be drinking a juice box. What are you doing? it's just he tends to have Daredevil leaning up against walls drinking things a lot. I don't know any other way to describe it. I also want to say that we were talking about iconic images. This is actually this has one of the most iconic images probably all of the 80s, which is that shot of Bullseye using one of Elektra's Psi and holding her off the ground with the Psi coming through the back of her costume.
There's your penetration.
That's a really famous image, and they actually managed to reproduce that really well in the movie.
Yeah.
It's one of the few times in the movie where I went there and went, that's very Daredevil, you know?
The other iconic shot is, of course, that you're talking then about the death of Elektra. The other iconic shot is one of the other major things here is that superheroes don't kill.
Yeah.
And Daredevil, for all intents and purposes, does. Now it's he doesn't. It's not through. It's open to interpretation because he's in a situation where he's holding Bullseye dangling off a wire. And you could say that his hand slipped. You could interpret it that he deliberately let him go.
I think he deliberately let him go because it's always been that Daredevil goes out and basically brings to justice the criminals where the legal system lets him down.
And he says his line is, "You'll kill no one ever again." He says just before doing it.
It sounds pretty intentional to me.
But I mean, some people, you know, you could open it to interpretation. But the thing is, this is. You know, it's kind of like one of those things like, you know, would Gwen Stacy have died if Spider-Man had, you know, web slung her or, and all that sort of thing. It is such an iconic moment because he is kind of the Batman, I guess, in a lot of ways of the Marvel Universe, sort of.
But darker.
but darker, if that's possible.
Well, Daredevil's a really dark character.
When you dig down, you're talking about someone who was blinded when he was a kid from a radioactive chemical spray.
He's got all that Catholic guilt.
His father was killed.
Yeah.
He has this, well, like, I mean, in this story here in particular, one of his first great loves is also killed.
First of all, she turns into an assassin and kills people. And then she's killed.
Absolutely. So we were talking about, a character that does go to some fairly dark places. So it is kind of like, you know, whereas Batman has that one simple rule he will never cross, which is he does not kill.
Mm.
Daredevil does. But you see how far this guy has to be pushed in order to break that rule.
Yeah, yeah. And, speaking of, well, kill, Elektra kills. A lot. Mm. I'm trying to remember how many people she stabbed in this series. There's a lot of deaths.
Look, I think if you flick through the trade paperback quickly, it's kind of like it's a motion comic of her killing.
Stabbing, gutting, stabbing, gutting, stabbing, gutting. And then you've got the other ninjas who are doing all the other stabbing and gutting. So,
except
there's
that one scene where she's like impossibly contorted in the bikini.
I actually just had that frame up on screen 2 seconds ago. Yeah, that's not a bad shot.
Yeah, that's just randomly to show you that she does more than just kill. She also does yoga.
Except in the next panel, in her bikini, she's throwing her size and killing somebody. Oh, no, she's trying to kill Daredevil.
She's trying to
kill Daredevil, but she misses. That's right. Misses on purpose.
A couple of pages later, she's killing people.
Yeah, of course. But that's after... she kills somebody after we have another wonderful piece of exposition where he talks about somebody and his billy club.
His billy club.
Yeah, she says, he goes, and my trusty billy club.
There it is, and let my trusty billy club do the rest. There it is.
I told you. At least he's not talking about the nylon cord in that one. That's a couple pages away.
I reckon there's a PhD in this.
Daredevil
and his billy club and his 30 feet of nylon cord. I would like to point out that Kermit the Frog has a cameo.
Really?
In this thing, as an inflatable Kermit the Frog in issue 178. There's like a the Macy's Day Parade kind of thing, the Thanksgiving Parade.
Oh, there is too. There is.
And
there's
just this giant Kermit the Frog.
Very good spot. Very good spot.
Which I only noticed because on our other, of course, he gets deflated. So he would not have been sane at that point.
Oh, hang on. Issue 176. He's leaning up against the counter drinking a juice box again. That's two juice boxes.
Do you reckon at this point he needs to be played by Brad Pitt, who is the master of food acting?
Of food acting, of course, absolutely. Yeah. You can have him leaning against things, just eating and drinking the entire way through.
The whole thing. Whenever Daredevil's poised for a moment, anything he's doing, any downtime he's got, he's eating something. He's talking to a cop and he's got a coffee in his hand, he's got the juice box, he's just chowing down on some fries while he's being debriefed, you know.
I think that would be awesome.
Yeah. That's the Daredevil movie I want to see. It's dark, it's about food.
I think he's still got the physique for it, don't you?
Brad Pitt?
Yeah.
Yeah. There was talk a few years ago of him doing Captain America. And that would have been kind of cool, but I'm glad they got Chris Evans.
I think Chris Evans nailed it.
Yeah.
But I'd like to see. Well, look, you know, they've had Ben Affleck play Daredevil. They can put anybody in that
scene. Yeah, and I don't think Ben Affleck even had his own hair at that stage. So
Daredevil was such a... I mean, there's a film where it had so much potential.
I was so looking forward to that film.
And it actually has some really good moments in it, but it just doesn't work as a whole. I will say the director's cut is actually better.
Yeah, no, I agree with you because it does add that little bit in there. We may as well talk about the film a little bit because it does tie directly to...
It does. I mean, the film is really an adaptation of this arc that we have here. And I think that the problem is that they actually missed some of the... They missed some of the heart that the books had.
Yeah, and it's easy to do in a two-hour film.
It is, and that's why the director's cut helps a little bit because it's actually about 2.5 hours long. But it still doesn't quite make it.
No, and the I think, I mean, the film was miscast. I think they needed, and both of the leads were miscast. I didn't mind Colin Farrell as Bullseye.
He was okay. I really didn't like his look.
I didn't like his look, though. I didn't like the fact that they'd carved the bullseye into his head.
Yeah, I wouldn't have tattooed the bullseye. I thought that was wrong.
Yeah. The Ben Affleck, I think he got Daredevil more right than he got Matt Murdock.
Yeah, I think Daredevil was okay. And I think, look, I didn't actually hate Ben Affleck as Daredevil. I really didn't.
But John Favreau made a good Foggy.
He made a great Foggy, absolutely. Jennifer Garner was definitely miscast.
They needed someone a bit more, and if you were casting it now, you'd go more exotic. You'd go
I didn't buy her as Greek to start with. No. And I know this is really incredibly superficial, but she didn't have the right look, and she needed the costume. I mean, it's a very iconic costume.
Yeah.
She didn't have the right look.
She didn't have the right costume, but she was too much of a star known for good person roles. So, I mean, she was in – she was doing Alias at that stage, was she?
She just finished, I think.
She was known for playing the good guy, effectively. And I know she was known for kicking ass, but I couldn't connect with her as someone being – an assassin had been trained for years.
No.
You know?
And that's not to say that, I mean, there are great moments in it, like when she's doing the sandbag training sequence, and you sit there and go, it looks really good, but I still don't buy it as Elektra.
And let's not even get into the Elektra film.
No, I don't think we'll go there. I don't think we need to really go there at all. The only thing I'll give the Elektra film in any way, shape, or form is the fact that at least her costume was a little closer.
Yes, it was. Yeah, no. Like the thing is about Elektra is a character who dies at the end of this book, and Frank Miller's intention was that she was to remain dead.
Yeah,
that was the tragedy of the thing. But they brought her back, and I've got to say that there is another book that Frank Miller did called Elektra Lives, which is as big. If you can get it, it's a big, oversized white hardcover. It's beautiful.
Right.
It's just really great, and that's kind of the much later art. It looks more like a 300 style kind of stuff. Another writer basically brought back Elektra as an ongoing character. She's had her own series, she's done her own thing, and then you have that ongoing problem of what to do with a character like Elektra, kind of like they did with, they've sort of got around it with Catwoman. But they never were quite as successful with the lecture of giving her an ongoing series, but having to make her sympathetic to the
when she's going around killing people.
So sometimes they had her retiring from that life. They had her doing that, but there were only bad people that she was killing. You know, and all this kind of the stuff. So it is. I mean, like, you know, it's a problem with the Punisher as well, but. Which is a whole other conversation.
Which also doesn't work on film. We've noticed this is
exactly
another one that
because
doesn't work.
You have a character. Once you get past the fact that Frank Castle is avenging his wife and child, you basically just have a guy who enjoys killing people.
That's right.
It works all right in comics because you can every week you can have a different writer with different visual gags and particularly when someone like Garth Ennis is doing it. But on film, it doesn't work as well. And getting back to Daredevil. And the Elektra film. The Elektra film just didn't give us sufficient reason to have Elektra in existence after the end of that film. And this book, to its credit, it what it does is give Daredevil a story of great epic loss, where he not only loses the woman he loves again, but he also loses probably that last lingering thread of righteousness that he had, which was he hadn't killed.
That's right, yeah.
You know, and so he's lost so much by the end of this book. So when you get to something like Born Again years later, I'm looking up when Daredevil Born Again came around.
While you're looking that up, I'll just say that you're right, because there's that issue or two issues of this sequence where Elektra has died and Murdoch is completely distracted by the fact that he believes she's still alive, saying she couldn't have died. And he's basically not focusing. His relationships are failing. He's not doing well in his court. And there's a point where he actually even gets a court order to exhume her body.
That's right, yeah.
Because he wants to prove that she's still alive. And, of course, there's that moment where he finally gets the body dug up and he realizes it is her. And yeah. He just screams, you know, and it's like he can't believe that she is actually dead.
The yeah, exactly right. And by 40 issues later, Frank Miller's actually driven Daredevil into insanity. The Born Again one that I'm referencing is issues 227 to 233. And this is definitely one we should return to down the track. And basically it's described here as the story details Daredevil's fall to insanity and destitution at the hands of Kingpin, as well as his subsequent struggle to build a new life for himself. So ultimately where this book ends is where a long, slow slide for Daredevil begins.
You could almost argue that where this book ends is where modern Daredevil began.
Absolutely.
Yeah. This is like what we talked before with Grant Morrison's reinventing of Animal Man. This is kind of where they reinvented Daredevil. They brought him back, you know, and they made him a viable character.
That's right.
Hmm.
And Frank Miller actually left the book on issue 191. And in fact, Dennis O'Neill, who wrote the book that we're going to talk about next week, took over from that. And then Miller didn't return until 1985, which was with the Born Again thing. So there is this kind of follow through there. But then it doesn't get much better for Daredevil at that point, because Karen Page, his girlfriend, then becomes a heroin addicted porn star.
How far can they drag him
down? And then if you read go all the way up to Kevin Smith's run of Daredevil, which is he did that when he rebooted the book back in the late 90s, his run there, which is a fantastic run if you ever get to read it, it doesn't end well for Karen Page there either. And it's continuing thing, and Kevin Smith's got the same thing that Frank Miller played on, which is the Catholic guilt,
yeah,
and this real, how low can one man, you know, how many blows can one guy take before he snaps or goes into insanity? So Daredevil's always been an interesting character on that level, and I think this would have worked better if Miller had been more confident with his visual storytelling.
Yeah.
Which he was a few years later. And we're thinking this is only a couple of years after this. This would have finished in about the early 80s.
Yeah, because this is a very, very Basil exposition-y. And you're right. If he just trusts himself, there are actually panels
it's
in
like
this
Tintin.
Book. Yeah, it is a little bit. There are panels, there are pages in this book where you sit and go, you didn't need dialogue. We can actually tell exactly what's going on from your visuals. And yet they're just covered in balloons, basically telling us everything.
And we're only talking, you know, 3 or 4 years later, Miller does Dark Knight Returns, where he was confident with that visual layout, where you have things like televisions telling the story.
Yeah.
Of things, which is something when we go back to something we spoke about earlier in this series, something like Powers, still borrows from that visual storytelling that Miller created back in 86. So in this very short period of time, Miller came into his own as a story writer. But I think Daredevil has persisted, one, because of the story that it tells, but also it's because it's the first signs of Miller becoming what he eventually became before he plowed off the deep end on the other side.
Well said, sir. Well said, sir. Excellent. I just want to talk one more piece of visual humor that Miller injected into this. Aside from him eating and drinking his way through the comic book, I love the fact that he gets injured at one point and he's actually out doing his Daredevil thing with a cast and a crutch.
Yes,
I think that's brilliant.
There's
that one panel where he's up against the side of a building and he's obviously really high up, so he's obviously done his whole Billy Club thing and gone up there. But he's got a cast and he's got his crutch under his arm as he's on the side of the building. He's there going, really?
I like the scene when he's like running along the bridge and there's this old guy jogging. And he says, oh, what's the matter? Do you don't think I can keep up with you? And then Daredevil promptly runs up the side of the bridge.
So. And is it with the crutch and with the cast? Isn't there a scene, I think there is, where he's doing something and somebody says, another handicapped person says something and he throws him the crutch.
That's right, yeah.
It's like he just goes, here, have that.
But it's funny, they got all this visual humor throughout it, which ultimately leads us up to those very dark last couple of issues.
Mm.
Which is when of course he kills, and then as you said, he exhumes Elektra's corpse because he wants to prove to himself that she's dead, which is a very dark place for
a comic to go. Really
and so look, you know, and that's where this ends. It's basically him leaning over her body. Which looks pretty good for something that's been buried for a few days, I've got to say.
Yeah, she was a good-looking woman, you know?
She was a good-looking woman. She stayed so in death. And it's just saying, Foggy, she's dead. I loved her, Foggy. I loved her. And there's three panels of the cross over the grave as they're walking away. And it's just such a powerful little ending to a book that might have gone on a little too long. Because I said, we're talking 300-odd pages here. At the end of the day, is still a powerful and visual story.
Yeah, agreed. I think, look, in the long run, I actually really enjoyed it. And I kept with it. And
yeah.
I had no problem reading all 300 and whatever pages. I think that all combined, it's like 355 pages or something like that. I joke it's more, but I think it's like 355. I really liked it. I did. I liked it. Look, I am a Daredevil fan. It's interesting because I think I actually came into Daredevil later than this. When I originally started reading Daredevil. Some of these stories were familiar to me. Some of these issues were familiar, but not all of them. So it was very interesting going back and looking at them going, yeah, I remember some of this, but I don't remember all of it. You know, and it's actually very interesting going back and reading something that even if I have read some of it, I haven't read in at least, God, it's got to be 30 years. So,
yeah.
So it's very interesting going back and having a look at it. So I liked it. So thank you. Very nice choice.
It was not bad for one that I spontaneously chose at the very end of.
Now, that leads us to next week's book.
And so next week's book is going to be the very classic and one I've been wanting to do for ages, Green Lantern, Green Arrow book, which is going all the way back to the 70s, 1972. And this is issues 76 through to 1989, through to 89.
Yep.
Not that long, not issue 76.
I say, how long are we going to be reading this time? Come on.
It's issues 76 through to 89, which is, and incorporating a few other little bits and pieces along the way, which, it's been collected together many times as Hard Traveling Heroes, or Green Lantern, Green Arrow, collected series. You'll see them in various things. There's been hardcovers. There's been several trade paperbacks. In the 80s, it was collected together again as seven issues. Look, you know, but basically we're talking about the Green Lantern, Green Arrow team-up, which was the first time that Green Arrow actually had his name in the title of a book.
I'm curious. Remembering back to the Inked series that we watched, they actually talked about this series because this was the one that had one issue, which was an anti-drug issue.
There's an anti-drug issue, and you'll find that is issue 86 of this run, so it's getting towards the end of it.
And this was the one where they had trouble with the Comics Code people because they were basically saying you couldn't do this, and they were saying, but we're doing this because the government asked us to.
Yeah, exactly. So. But also, it's got one of the most reprinted pages in comics history ever.
Really?
Which is where, and this was on the record books for a long time, where there's this African-American character who's saying to Green Lantern, you know, you do a lot. I see what you do. You fly around space. You do a lot for the purple skins and the pink skins and the green skins. But what are you doing for the black skins, you know? And what are you doing for the people here? And off the back of that and off his liberal, small L liberal friend, Green Arrow going, you know, hey, there's a whole world out there that needs us. They just hit the road and they go off looking for problems across America, which was revolutionary in the 70s to sort of admit that heroes couldn't heroes couldn't solve everything.
Yeah. Very, very interesting pick. And it'll also be very interesting to look at the writing style. Yes,
and look, I've read this a bunch of times over the years, so it'll be interesting for me to now go back. Having said what we've said this week about Frank Miller, to go back and read it with those eyes.
Yeah, no, it's going to be a very, very good read. So we've done Marvel. Let's have a look at DC's heyday. So
this is going to be a very personal one for me, so I'm a little scared.
I'll go easy on you.
Thanks, David.
All right, we're running late again, so we're going to wrap this up. Hey, what?
I said, hey, we've
hey, oh, fair. I thought you were asking me something. All right, Richard, where can people find more of you on the internet?
They can find me on therealbits.com. That's the RELLbits.com. It's mainly a film website, but I've been slipping in a bit of comics and TV news there as well.
Yay.
And also on Twitter at DVDBits, which I'm literally on right now.
You're literally on right now. You're typing as you speak to me.
I'm reading it, but I'm
Oh, fair enough. Okay. You can find more of me by going to geekactually.com, and you can also follow me on Twitter at David McVeigh. You can find all the links about me just by going to geekactually.com. There's a follow us button, and it's got everything on there. Now, we should also point out that we do a film show, just in case those who are coming to this show for the first time haven't heard of what else we do. We do a film show called Film Actually, which is a lot of fun. You can find that on iTunes. This just in. Sorry, our studio audience here is basically saying that we should promote Smile because it's almost ready and it will be out very soon. And that is, of course, from my son who makes Lego animated films, and he's got a new Batman film coming out, which is almost done now. I heard the music the other day, by the way, Richard. Awesome. His composer has done a really good job.
We'll look at that more. We'll look at that on the show when it comes out.
I think we will. Although it's kind of long. I don't know if we can do the whole thing. We might do a little bit of it.
We'll talk about it anyway. We'll put links out in our show notes.
Absolutely.
And we'll put links out
about, if you want both to find, of our sites. If you want to find out more about it, and there is a trailer for this up already, go to youtube.com/Nicky McVeigh, and you can actually find all of his Lego animated films. Okay, I think that's it. I think we're done. I think we're going to go home.
I am home, David.
We are home. it's been a long day. We're going to head out of here. Richard, I will see you next week.
I'll see you then.
With the Green Lantern, Green Arrow team up. Sounds good.
Yay!
All right, Richard. See you next week. See you next week, everybody. Bye-bye.